How's it going, everybody? Mike back at you with another edition of 5 Minute Gaming. And today I am happy to have a special guest with me again on this show to talk about that the planets have gone mad. David Thiel, welcome back to the show. Appreciate you again taking your time to spend some time talking about another one of the great video games that you worked on called Mad Planets. And when the word Mad Planets comes up, tell us what you think of when this game comes up in conversation or just in a memory. What do you think of? Tell us a story.
I think of Khan. I think of Khan Yamamoto. That's who I think of because it was really his baby. He worked so hard on this for quite some time. And Khan was an interesting guy. I'd never worked with someone whose primary language was Japanese and English was his second language. And I mean, he spoke very fine English. I can understand it, but with a strong accent. And he used to bring these little boxed bento lunches, you know, this Japanese stuff. And I, you know, so everything about Khan was really interesting to me. And he had a crazy background. He came to Gottlieb from Kraft Foods. He was a food engineer.
Wow.
And, you know, making a better cheese food or something. He didn't talk all that much about what he had done there, but clearly video game programming was a passion for him. He was we were the same age. He was a couple of years older. And we had one other person named Jun Yum. He was a Korean fella. And he was the hardware engineer that created the Gottlieb graphics system. I think he had come from Bally or Midway or somewhere. And he created not their system, but he created a system, you know, based on what he knew. He created a newer, better system. And when they were trying to bring this board up, it was a big, complicated board with custom pipelines for background and sprites and stuff. Khan was the guy because he needed, you know, software to tickle the board, the hardware board, to see if it was going to work. And so Khan was the guy before he was doing any game code, putting in the hard work with Jun. But we have this thick Japanese accent and then this thick Korean accent. And when they would be like intensely talking to each other, trying to, you know, explain where this port was or where the scan line was, whatever. And the thing I remember when Jun tried to say the word zero, he would go dito. It would always be dito, dito, one, 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 dito, dito. And then Khan would be excitedly going, no, 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 no. And so the two of them, when they were like poring over this board, trying to bring it to life, it was a stitch. It was great. So that was Khan's early days at Gottlieb, bringing the system up. But once the system was up and he paid his hard dues on that, he poured himself into, he wanted to come up with a game. And he came up with something that was kind of organic. You know, you think about games at that time, and there's an awful lot of pattern games, right? Like Pac-Man's a pattern game. Donkey Kong's a pattern game. There's a lot of these games where, you know, you learn the pattern. The pattern's not that dynamic. Khan didn't want to do anything like that. So Mad Planets, while simulates a lot of physics, right? There are all these things that swoop in and they have these crazy orbits. I mean, we have planets who are attacking you. Why? Who knows? and they come in and the patterns that they do are con physics, but they're physics. They're not following patterns. They're algorithms doing simulations of physical forces and stuff, and they influence each other. So something will temporarily perturbate something else's stuff. And getting all that working was interesting, and then making it fun. Khan tweaked this thing like crazy until he was getting it to the point where he believed it was fun, and he chose a fairly complicated control mechanism. Mad Planets conceptually is as different from Qbert as anything could be, running on the same exact system. And so you could control the X, Y, up, down, left, right, you know, with a joystick of your position, but you could then rotate around. And so you could be moving right and firing left, right? You can be backing up and firing in the opposite direction, and you can spin around. And it's a very organic game.
I agree.
Not pattern-based at all.
As I was practicing on this game, I found thinking about that you have to think in an up, down, left, right direction, but also in a degree increment of spinning your ship and then fire. And that does involve using a little bit more of your brain than in Pac-Man, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. This gets intense. Well, we were all inspired. All video games were inspired by Robotron. And Robotron has that, right? You can move with one stick, you fire with the other stick. And that's a very intense control paradigm. And so we were all looking for that intensity. You know, I wouldn't say Mad Planet's copies Robotron in any way other than that, in that, you know, you have two independent things that you're trying to use to your benefit. So coming off of Qbert, my next project was Mad Planet. And I started dealing with Khan as now a client for Sounds. I mean, I'd been eating lunch with him and hanging out with him for probably more than a year to this point. And now, you know, I'm going to provide what he needs to help make his game more fun. And he wanted something which is challenging to do with the Gottlieb soundboard. He wanted, you can't do it. You can't have two simultaneous complicated things running at the same time. That's true of the Robotron system as well. These systems that make sounds by running algorithms, these boards don't have very much horsepower. So you can't run two complicated algorithms at the same time. It's just, you don't have enough power to do it. You could do it, but then the sampling rate would go down so low, it would sound like garbage. When you're hearing a sound, you're hearing an algorithm being run. And then when a new sound starts, you're not hearing that sound running anymore. And then you keep running new algorithms. And Khan wanted a background. He wanted a background running in the background and when you're shooting. So, but shooting and explosions and all this stuff. So I said, well, let's see what we can get away with. And so I do have a background that runs, but of course it gets interrupted by the explosions and by shooting. And so if you shoot constantly, you won't hear the background.
I noticed that very thing practicing yesterday.
Yeah. The minute you stop shooting, the background comes back. And
yep.
I don't think I do anything. I think it comes back where it left off. I mean, it's not like it runs in the background. It's just being muted. I mean, it literally has to stop, but it can resume exactly where it was when it's not being asked to do something else.
Well, we should test that theory while we're playing and see. You'll be able to tell me probably better than myself if it works. I have a little bit of information to share about Mad Planets from the wiki. It's not a lot, but it lends a little bit of information of the game. Mad Planets is a multi-directional shooter released in arcades in 1983 by Gottlieb. The player controls a spaceship, which can be moved and rotated independently to fend off angry planets and angry moons attacking from all directions. It was designed and programmed by Khan Yabamoto, with art by Jeff Lee and sound by David D. Thiel. Lee and Thiel previously worked on Qbert for Gottlieb, a game that was inspired by a pattern of hexagons implemented by Yabamoto. Khan Yabamoto died in 2017 of a degenerative lung disease. When is the last time you remember speaking with Khan, David?
We remained in contact pretty much to the end. Several years before, maybe in 2014 or 15, Khan made it up to the Milwaukee Game Show. And there was a Gottlieb panel. And I was there virtually. They projected my image, my Skype image, on a sheet. And Khan was there, and he had this lung disease for quite some time. And so I think he had a little tank of oxygen with him, but a bunch of Gottlieb guys were there, including Khan. And we all talked Gottlieb stuff, and Khan and June, after Gottlieb went away, formed a little company, and they did software utilities and stuff. So Khan stayed in it on 8-bit computers, doing software things right up pretty much till the end. He was a gentleman and a scholar and a most innovative guy, very, very determined to make fun. He wanted to make fun.
That's awesome.
And he did.
It's great to hear the stories and hear those things. That, in a way, then he can live on in our memory of his contributions to these awesome games. How to play. The player uses a flight-style joystick to move a spaceship around a dark starfield, a rotary knob to orient the ship, and a trigger on the stick to fire. At the beginning of a level, planets appear and begin growing. They can be destroyed prior to their reaching full size and sprouting moons. If a wave is completed by destroying all planets before they reach full size, a substantial bonus is awarded. Once a planet has moons, it is shielded until all its moons have been destroyed or launched at the player's ship, at which point the planet becomes angry and charges the player. I love how they're birthing moons and becoming angry. I don't think I've ever heard of that concept in my life, except in this game. And then we have floating astronauts, which appear in mini bonus rounds after every third level, every fourth after level 12. They can be collected by flying over them. Orbiting comets accelerate the longer they go without being shot. comments increase the value by 100 points to a maximum of 1,000 until a comment leaves the screen or the level ends. That is the extent of information on this game as far as the Wikipedia. And I do have then some other cool stuff, though, to show. This is advertising materials. I really like that art a lot. It's really well made. I don't know, David, if you remember who created that.
It's either Jeff Lee or Rick Tracy. I'm not sure which guy. I would tend to think cabinet art was usually Rick's thing. So
looks great. And here we have the flyer with some of the marketing speak that I love. You and your ship are trapped in the path of the approaching planets, all intent on destroying you. They hurl their moons out of orbit and at your ship. You must first destroy all the moons. The planet itself is temporarily protected by a force field. When the moons are destroyed, the planet becomes vulnerable to your attack. It grows red with anger and attacks your ship while the battle rages. Fierce comets enter the arena to make your mission even more dangerous. Save the marooned astronauts for bonus points. After every attack wave comes a bonus round. Keep hitting the comets and you keep playing, picking up astronauts for bonus points. Mad Planet's sensitive dual controls respond instantly to your commands. The action is fast and furious, and only the pilot with nerves of steel will escape the fury of Mad Planets. I've talked at many shows about how I love this descriptive, setting the stage, marketing speak, I call it, because I think you needed to do that because you had limitations on telling a story in the graphics themselves. So this just creates a feeling, an environment, a setting, and I thoroughly enjoy reading this old stuff that I think is mostly long forgotten because these flyers were never even really seen by the public. They were just seen by operators.
Yeah.
Any thoughts, David, you have on all this fun descriptive adjective text?
It was great. It was kind of funny. Like in Tim's first game, Reactor, I forget what his code name was for it, but you know, it was really, he had just some dynamics and some objects and things. And it was a game and it was fun, you know, but it had no theme.
Yeah.
The marketing guys came in and then they suggested, well, how about nuclear stuff? How about you're inside a reactor core? And then, you know, Tim embraced that and expanded on that. But a lot of times these games initially were about control and hit detection and movement and largely abstract kinds of notions. And so, yeah, it's kind of funny to see the marketing guys say, well, this is what you've got. Okay, let's see. What can we do with this? I'm not sure in this game if this was all from Khan or not. It probably was. Khan was a very creative guy.
Yeah, he probably had some creative input, I'm sure.
Yeah.
This is a nice picture of the arcade cabinet itself. Mm-hmm. And then a close-up of the controls. And this is one of those games that is very difficult to play on emulation because what you see on your right hand, you've got a control stick with a trigger for firing, and that controls the movement of your shift. And on the left is a spinner. And any arcade game with a spinner is very difficult to play on any type of emulation system on a PC or anything because there just is not a spinner naturally built into Windows controls. You can use the mouse, and I tried it, but it is not easy. So I'll be playing with the controller today and will not be rotating quite as much, but I've found a way that I can play enough because we're here to listen to the sounds. This is very similar to Tron, which is an arcade game I loved growing up.
Mike, we didn't talk about this, but if you play the attract mode with the sound on, that's a real faithful rendition of the game being played. Khan figured out a way to capture all the gesture from the controls.
Yeah.
And then he had a competition in the shop and people played the game and he recorded all their stuff and the people with the best games ended up being the attract mode play. So that's not algorithmic. That's playing back a recording of some really good play.
Well, we'll get right to that. We can do that. Definitely. Let's just finish these couple slides. This is just an image from my database. Does this bring back any memories, David, just even looking at that, the board of the game?
Yes. Look at that. See, that's the board, that big one.
Yeah.
That's the one Khan and Jun were yelling about. Because that was a complicated board, and making that thing work was tricky.
And the soundboard is in the upper right, correct?
Yes, yes, that's my little baby. You can see it pretty well there.
And I'm guessing the lower right would be the power supply.
That's the power supply. I'm not sure the thing next to the soundboard, I'm not sure what that is.
Yeah, it's a long, thin PCB. And then there's also another one on the upper left, a small daughter board.
Yeah, that might be the control board, like for a trackball or the track wheel.
Sure.
Because that stuff was not on the main board. That main board, I mean, that's you mostly, this is a time before ASICs or F whatever those are called, the FPGAs. So this is all like mostly a TTL implementation of a graphics pipeline.
Sure.
It was intense, and it was the same processor as the IBM PC of its day before it went to the 8086. So the big chip on there was the 8088. So it was the same thing as the PC, which allowed the aforementioned, well, I think we talked about him in another video, Jim Weiss, created this system that could plug in to that big board, mm-hmm. that could basically make that game board like a peripheral for the PC, which means you could use a PC to develop for this.
Sure. That's huge.
And you could use debug tools and assembly compilers, assemblers, whatever you had on the PC. And then this board would think was in the PC's address space or IO space. So that allowed for a reasonably cheap environment to support lots and lots of developers that most game houses didn't have. So we had a lot of people working on games because we could afford to, because all they needed was a PC and this plus another big board that kind of plugged into it. And that was the really a great idea by Jim Weiss. Gets all the kudos and credit for that.
That is it for my pre-slideshow. We can get right to the attract mode. I'm going to turn that sound on. And it's great to know this is actual recording of a real person playing the game.
Yep. Somebody good.
Yeah.
Really good.
Yeah, someone really good. Their brain is working in all those directions very successfully.
Picking up astronauts. Ah, another astronaut. Oh, gonna get that astronaut. Yes! No!
Oh.
No, he never got it.
He's trying.
He's trying. There you go.
Were you around when the people were in, the players were in doing this?
Yep. I may have even tried, but I didn't get anywhere close to the really good players.
Well, you're number 16.
Yeah. So that could have been, you know, Khan was really good at his own game.
And I like a track.
So there's that music that you generally won't hear during gameplay.
Yeah, I was thinking that. And there's our point values of our planets. Well, just for the fun of it, I'm going to play a little bit and put in my quarter. That's a familiar sound.
Yeah, that's sort of, I didn't feel the need to make, we made that the corporate, we recognize you gave us money sound.
All right, and here we are. So again, I can't really turn that easy if I hold down on the button all the way. The one joke I have is this is my Death Blossom move from The Last Starfighter, if you ever saw that movie. But otherwise, I can just do this. And I have set up invincibility to make it easier to survive these levels, just to show a little bit of what happens in the future. But there's the music, and if I fire, the music goes away, like you were talking.
See, the tempo of the music's gotten pretty intense.
Astronauts.
Bonus round. Music's cranking.
That's probably enough to share, David.
Yeah.
What I learned practicing the game yesterday, there is really nothing else that changes. You just continue to play similar levels.
The thing that's interesting to me is that the first time I ever really did continuous music in a game, that I made it as interactive as I could. So as you progress through the three rounds, the music gets faster for each round. So that third round, the same tune, it is cranking. It is like crazy fast. And then when you clear that round, you go to the next wave, it's back down to where it was. But okay. I'm not sure if it's up one notch or not. But yeah, I had, since it was algorithmic music, I had that control. So we bound it to, you know, the difficulty of the wave when you can hear it, which is hardly at all, because people who play this game just fire and have that fire hose of laser shots coming out of the end. There's one interesting thing about this, I suppose. I don't know if it's interesting to anybody but me. The explosions, I mean, explosion routines are, you know, explosion algorithms are interesting and difficult. Initially, when I was trying to make them, I tried to make them like a synthesizer guy would make them. You start with noise and you filter it. That's how you make explosions. But you don't have enough horsepower to make a decent filter. And even if you make a decent filter, having it sweep, changing the parameters to make it sweep, you just, that's too complicated. And so again, your sample rate dives so far, you know, you're then sampling at 2K instead of 48. So, you know, you can't hear anything. I went for a while trying to figure out how to make explosion routines. And then I was invited over by Eugene Jarvis and Larry DeMar to come over to the VidKids and see how they made explosions, or not see that, but to see their thing. We were talking about maybe working together. And so then they have a whole library of all the Williams sounds, and that's their approach. They keep them in a library, and you know, they're not for a game or anything. They're just Williams sounds. And then they got to that big explosion. I don't know if you remember Defender.
I do. Oh, I know exactly what explosion you're talking about.
At the very end, there's this big, beautiful, crunchy, huge explosion.
Yep.
Well, while they were playing it, they had an oscilloscope attached to it. And I said, could you turn that on? And so I watched it, and I only had to look at their explosion algorithm running for, you know, about 5 seconds. And I knew exactly what they were doing. And it was very clever, of course, because Eugene Jarvis probably wrote that thing. He wrote sound routines. That was the very first thing he did when he got to Williams all those years ago. So. Now, I didn't want to copy them, but it was a great technique. And so I started with what they did. I found 4 or 5 ways I could extend it. So I could make a whole range of explosions. I could make big crunchy ones, and I could make like continuous rumbles, low rumbles. And I could make all these different kinds of things, which they couldn't. They weren't sound guys, really, so I don't think they cared as much as I did. So I figured out how to extend this algorithm, because I needed this for Mad Planets. Because what is Mad Planets? It's shooting and explosions.
Yeah.
And if you listen, there's a whole bunch of different explosions, you know, and they're keyed to the size of the planet and how angry it is. and it gives it the kind of variety that you need when you're going to have, when you have a game that's nothing but firing and explosions, you need a whole lot of variety and interesting kinds of explosions. That's my story. I would have to show you on graph paper to show you what I actually did.
I like hearing that the Williams people invited the Gottlieb people over to chat and collaborate and share knowledge.
At the time, I didn't know that Eugene was the sound programmer for Flash. Now, you go back to Flash, that was Steve's first game.
Steve Ritchie.
When Williams hired Steve Ritchie from Atari, the legend goes that he designed Flash on an airplane napkin as he was flying from the West Coast to Chicago. And the thing that one of the things that makes Flash such a remarkable game is its audio. You look at all the other games, and Gottlieb was the leader at that time, right? Gottlieb was the big pinball company at that time.
Sure.
But as things became digital, Gottlieb lost its lead. It was they didn't choose a very good way of using microprocessors and developing and stuff. They screwed up, and that was Williams' opportunity to take over the market. And Steve's first game out of the gate for Williams is his biggest selling game ever. They sold over 20,000 of those things.
Yeah.
And the reason why, I think, is if you went to an arcade at that time with a line of pinball machines, and people are playing them, And it's like Flash came from another universe. When you hear the sound package, compare that to the sounds being made by the Gottlieb game and the Bally game. There was just no comparison. So there are sound packages for pinball before Flash and then after Flash.
You're right. Flash had a great sound to it.
Flash has that's the beginning of the, and to be fair, there was a guy who had created the original sound routines. That wasn't Eugene, but Eugene came in and took that stuff and ran with it and began making all these amazing sounds. And then it just became the Williams sounds, and they're in a bunch of their pinballs. And then they use the same sounds for Defender and Robotron and all those games. It is just the Williams sound, and they are great.
Yep.
And you know, I come in using the same notion, same, you know, 8-bit DAC and a processor, and I don't want to, you know, I'm not going to make the sounds they make. I have to find my own space. It was actually, you know, pretty hard to stay out of their space because they had already found some really great stuff. I had to find my own stuff.
I could see that.
But Eugene appreciated having had done it, and he saw Reactor, and he really thought, you know, the music in Reactor is pretty nifty, and he respected Heat more than anybody else on the planet at that time. He knew exactly how hard it was and what I was doing.
Right.
And he appreciated it. So he asked me to come over because he was interested in, you know, collaborating.
And that's great. It's kind of the opposite of the story we talked about on the Qbert show where they made you have fake names in a news article so no one would know who you were.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, it's a small industry. And that's why that was so pointless because anybody who could hire you knew who you were.
Yeah.
So it was silly for them to try to keep you anonymous from the general public. What's the point?
I'm sad to say I don't ever remember playing this in my childhood. I can't remember seeing this game.
It has a cult following. I don't know how many they made, but it wasn't a ton. This was the beginning of the end for Chicago video game coin op for a while. Not Mad Planet specifically, but the end of 83 going into 84 and 85, operators had just purchased so many of the successful games, so many Pac-Mans, you know, because, well, hey, if one Pac-Man earns $200 a week, 10 Pac-Mans earn $2,000 a week.
Yeah.
And just, they kept buying and buying. And so then when the appeal of that, you know, they reached saturation, they'd already spent their money. They had bought all these Pac-Mans.
Right.
And they didn't have much of a budget at that point to buy other games. And the business model of coin-op was the problem. Because you know, the company who's making Mad Planets or Defender or any of that, make the game and sell it. And then they don't see a dime from its operation. Well, this is kind of a flawed business plan, right? Because if you make a wonderfully successful game, the operator's not going to come back to you for anything for a while. They don't need any of your new product because you made such a good one. So really, you want to make a product that earns great for 9 months and then just self-destructs.
That's such a tricky, tricky thing, isn't it? To engineer like that.
Yeah, and nobody would run a film studio that way. You don't sell the film. You license it and then you get a percentage of every ticket sold. And you retain the ownership of the thing. And so you make enough money so you can go on and keep making, you know, good films. But for coin-op, we're just beginning to get home consoles and stuff, and the amount of money you have to spend to make game number one is going up and up and up, but you're not selling them for that much more.
Yeah.
So 3 years from now you're selling games for $3,500, but it's probably costing you 10 times as much to develop the first game because all your production values have gone up so high and you still don't get a dime. Let's say you make a wonderfully successful game. You don't get a dime from the operation of that wonderfully successful game. You get the $3,500 that you get for selling it. So it was a bad business model. And the Japanese companies were shrewd. Some of them owned arcades. And so Namco owned its own arcades. I think Sega owned a string of their own arcades as well. And so they would sell it to other operators, but they operated it themselves. So they got, you know, some of that money for per play money. The entire time that I was with IT before I moved here, I was part of the executive board and we used to sit around the table going, well, what are we going to do? Are we going to open up arcades? What can we do to get some of that per play dollar? because what we're doing now is just treading water, and it's becoming increasingly hard to make these games, increasingly more expensive, and yet what we can charge for them doesn't rise proportionately. Eventually, we're not going to be able to do this. And the home game platforms are getting very, very competitive with anything that we can do, because they're amortizing their effort off of millions of units.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a hit game for CoinOp for us would be 10,000 units, right? And so amortizing the development of making a graphics pipeline and development tools and all that stuff across 10,000 units that you charge a lot more for, it doesn't work.
Well, that's why Nolan made the Chuck E. Cheese chain too.
Yes, yes, exactly. It's a way you want to get, and you know, I don't think the CoinOp guys would have ever gotten greedy. If operators would have given them 10%, I think everything would have been fine. But the reason they didn't want to do that, one of the major reasons, is the coin operated business for a long time was like money laundering, right? You're an operator, and all your business is a cash business. I mean, it's in quarters, right?
Yeah.
And so if some guy with a vowel at the end of his name has a whole bunch of money that wants to, you know, make that clean, you can run it through that business, right?
Yes, right.
And so they were loath to report anything vaguely like reality, or any reporting at all was anathema to them.
David and I did another show on Qbert that I'm going to put a link to right up there, where we get into the real deep stories and experiences of what it was like to make a game about a very, very endearing character who is still well known today in popular culture. So head on over to the Qbert show and we'll continue the fun and talk about Qbert.